Welcome to the Libertarian Institute YouTube and Odyssey channel. Today, I am joined by my executive editor, Sheldon Richmond at the Libertarian Institute, and our news editor, Kyle Anzalone. We have our first story here, which is, let me find it, Bernie Sanders versus Milton Friedman on healthcare. Sheldon, what is this one about?
Well, this is fun. I don't know who put this together. I didn't find an individual's name, but this is a YouTube channel that juxtaposed footage of Bernie Sanders talking about the national shame that we don't have Medicare for all, totally government run and taxpayer paid for medical care, and so juxtaposed with remarks made by Milton Friedman before a couple of different groups. I guess it's different pieces, but one of them comes from an address he gave to the Mayo Clinic, which was a room full of doctors. And his were from the 60s and 70s, I think. So obviously this was not an actual debate, but it begins with Sanders claiming there's a right of, it's a national disgrace that we don't have a right of citizenship included in the right of citizenship is guaranteed health care by the government. And then he goes on to talk in the other excerpts of his, they're interspersed. He goes on to talk about how Americans pay way too much for medical care. And that's a national shame if the government, of course, the implication, it's not just the implication. He says if the government were running it, medical care would cost much, much less because we all know how efficient government is. So how dare we do this? Friedman doesn't address the rights question, at least in any of the excerpts used, which is understandable. He's an economist. That wasn't his point. He just talked about the craziness of having the government do more and more in running medical care. So it's a very cool way to see these two views kind of at odds with each other. Friedman, of course, at least from the 60s, was proposing, and he did this in his book, Capitalism and Freedom, an end to medical licensure. You can imagine how radical that must have sounded in 1962 when that book came out, where he said government should not have, and as he says in one of these excerpts, should have no special role in private medical care whatsoever. He's not talking about public health now. He doesn't talk about that. But as far as private care goes, it ought to be totally privately funded. And of course, competition would yield great benefits and lower prices. So it's a fun view. The thing's only 6 minutes long, but it's really good to see Friedman in action. Friedman was a great debater, great handler of questions, and people should look him up and just watch how he handles himself. It's wonderful.
Kyle, Zelensky expands crackdown on Ukrainian media. Oh, the fight for democracy is pretty tough. Kyle, what do we have here?
Yeah, so this is an article that I wrote with Will Porter at the Libertarian Institute, and it's expanding on some coverage actually from March when the Ukrainian government first nationalized the media. And so this bill has been proposed and kicked around in the Ukrainian government for about 6 months now and has met a lot of criticism because what it intended to do was to basically expand the Ukrainian government's regulatory powers over broadcast media, over news media. So, essentially nationalizing even the print and the online media in Ukraine by requiring all media outlets to get a government some kind of government permission slip, some kind of government permit to conduct media, to conduct journalism. So, obviously this is a real problem. Now, a couple of the more problematic aspects of this bill that met a lot of criticism, even from, pro-Western civil rights groups, were taken out, and that would actually fine people for writing things that the Ukrainian government disagreed with. But the bill as it is still nationalizes another huge swath of the media from Ukraine. And so, this is really important because it's going to, create a real problem for any kind of information getting out of Ukraine and getting to the people.
One of my favorite things that Sheldon has brought to light is just the fake security scam that they always say, well, this is a matter of national security, so we got to, you know, nationalize the media. Well, if something is so vitally important, you wouldn't want a monopoly. You'd want voluntarily funded competition. That is one of my favorite things that our executive editor has taught me. My first contribution is from Kaiser Wilhelm's memoirs, published in, it looks like, 1921. He's going over his disagreement with Otto von Bismarck, who he refers to as the prince, and he summarized it as follows. Then came the labor protective legislation. I most deeply deplored the dispute which grew out of this, but at that time, it was necessary for me to take the road to compromise, which has generally been my road both on domestic and foreign politics. For this reason, I could not wage the open warfare against the social democrats which the prince desired. So this was the primary dispute. Otto von Bismarck said, look, we got to basically wage war on the left in this country. And Kaiser Wilhelm said, no, that's going to backfire and it's going to delegitimize the entire regime. So what ended up happening is they didn't, Bismarck ends up stepping down. And Kaiser Wilhelm then gives, you know, about 15 years later, gives Austria a blank check to go to war with Serbia, and they'll back them in case Russia comes in. Well, it turns out this is what brought down the German Empire. So they were so terrified and insecure of having a competitor in the government system that they expanded their empire, and they overexpanded to the point where they collapsed. Same thing happened with the French Empire. War took them down, and the British Empire and the Japanese Empire, and obviously the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Unfortunately, this is what is taking down the American Empire, not to mention the Soviet Empire. Both Russian empires fell because they were too thinly expanded. These statistics were just shocking. Military deaths in the First World War were 9 million. About 23 million wounded, getting their limbs blown off, getting PTSD, about 6 million civilian deaths, and about 2 million people died from disease because of this world war. This is the fire that we're playing with when we side with a regime like Zelensky's. We're not debating whether all of Ukraine should be alive or dead. The question is, who should be on the throne in Ukraine? So once you see it through that lens, you see that, look, I don't love Putin going in, but at the same time, are we going to send our sons and daughters to go die at the behest of the Zelensky regime, nationalizing the media, initiating conscription legislation, outlawing Russian orthodoxy throughout all of Ukraine, and so many other things. So that's why avoiding another conflict, whether it's with China or Russia, is so vitally important. All these deaths took place before nukes were around. So something very important that we have to look at. The risk is so big. And again, not because Germany invaded England and it was direct. It started with a little fight over Serbia and then a fight over Belgium. So just because Putin hasn't invaded Arizona through Mexico yet doesn't mean we aren't absolutely playing with fire here. Sheldon, our next one from the American Institute for Economic Research. What do we have here?
This is a very good article called, as you can see, Every Flaw in Consumers is Worse than Voters, Part 2. It's written by Michael Munger, who's a very good economist at Duke, inventive. He's written lots of books and lots of articles. And his point here, as you can probably tell from the title, is that the same person who is tends to be very smart in the marketplace when he makes his daily choices in the supermarket and other places is by necessity dumb in the voting booth. And of course, it's reasons libertarians should already be familiar with. There's a different set of costs and benefits, and various things like that that make markets better environments for smart decision-making than the political arena. As he says, the problem in this, every flaw in consumers is worse in voters. In artificial laboratory settings and sometimes in real-world choice settings, people are bad at making decisions, but they are better at choosing in markets where they have prices and brand names than those same people trying to choose in democratic political settings where advertising is intentionally misleading. Who's lived through a campaign and not seen that? And party brand names are almost meaningless. So there is no way in a democracy that state action can improve on market outcomes, save in a few narrow circumstances. Now, close quote. We might want to even take issue with that final phrase, but nevertheless, Munger's thesis is definitely correct. Voters tend to be stupid, and after all, the core reason there is one vote doesn't even count when you think about it. No, very few. The chances of a tie or a one vote margin in all but the very tiniest jurisdiction is pretty much meaningless. And yet, action in the marketplace by individuals is decisive. If I go to the store and I want cornflakes, I get cornflakes, and I also know what the price is. And I pay the cost out of my pocket. I take the thing home. If I don't like it, I realize next time I better buy something else, or if it's some bigger thing, I might be able to return it. All that stuff these days, of course, you can return anything. And so consumers smart, voters dumb. This is one reason why we're libertarians.
Kyle, what is going on with South Korea? I have not heard of them since Dan Crenshaw said we might have to go to war with North Korea and Iran and everyone else. What do we have here?
Yeah, so particularly since this started like the end of summer, but throughout 2022, there's been a lot of escalations. But through the second half of the year, myself, Connor Freeman, Will Porter, the news team at the Libertarian Institute has really covered a lot of what's going on. The U.S. has started to deploy more weapons that could carry nuclear, weapons into the region, aircraft carriers with F-35s, B-52s, different aircraft like this. They've conducted live fire war games for the first time since 2017 on the Korean Peninsula. They conducted the largest ever aerial war games. And maybe most significantly, the U.S. signed a trilateral defense pact with South Korea and Japan, and they did this on the sidelines of the NATO summit in Madrid. And so, you know, while they're doing all this work to make sure that they have the capabilities to confront Russia through Ukraine, that they're at the same time making these side deals, preparing to confront China with, you know, our proxy allies in South Korea and Japan. And recently, Japan's announced a spending plan where they're going to become, I believe, the third largest military spender in the next 5 years. They've essentially abandoned their peace era constitution from the end of the Second World War and are now really looking to ramp up their military capabilities. And so Will Porter has this particular article. South Korea says it will punish North Korea for provocations. And one of the things that Will looks at in this article is we had this new South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol. And he has been very aggressive and hawkish towards North Korea. During the period of diplomatic progress between the U.S. and North Korea, that was during the Trump era in the U.S. And so everybody kind of looks at that event and those talks through the lens of, you know, this was about Donald Trump, and they formed their opinions around that. Really, I think what it was about was the South Korean president, President Moon Jae-in, who was very interested, was a true believer in Korean peace, and had worked in previous governments working on Korean unity projects and things like that. You know, it was a long-term project of his. And so he really facilitated the talks between the U.S. and North Korea. And now we have Joe Biden, who has no interest in talks with North Korea, no interest in reaching out. I think to some extent, Kamala Harris has gotten to be involved in a lot of the Korea stuff. So, you know, she made a trip to the DMZ where she talked about the U.S. deploying its nuclear weapons against North Korea. So, you know, she goes and says South Korea is under the U.S. nuclear umbrella. We will use our nuclear weapons against North Korea in defense of South Korea. But North Korea, you have to give up your nuclear weapons. And so the U.S. policy has been an absolute disaster. And now we have a partner in South Korea who's don't know, equally hawkish, maybe even more hawkish than Joe Biden towards North Korea. And I don't see this cycle of escalation coming down anytime soon in 2023.
My next one, nonprofits never imagined Phoenix police would halt street feeding for homeless. I know I had a similar story next week. This one is still important, though. So this is from 2017. Three nonprofit organizations said they were shocked that Phoenix police shut down an event to give supplies to homeless people on Saturday. The Warm Streets of Phoenix event, hosted by Let's Be Better Humans campaign and One True Love, handed out blankets, clothing, hygiene items, water, and warm meals from Left Coast Burrito Company. So here is a classic example of people voluntarily getting together, four different organizations cooperating to help people. Sergeant Alan Full said Phoenix police officers were assigned to the area around Central Arizona Shelter Services, came across the event, and shut it down. The city of Phoenix encourages organizations to donate to and work with licensed shelters instead of conducting such street feeding events. John Linton, founder of the I Have a Name Project, said he's traveled across the country and has seen policies against people feeding and providing hygiene products to homeless people. It's happening everywhere, not just Arizona. He says, "I know very well that what we are doing on the streets isn't going to solve the issue," Linton said, "but it's a Band-Aid. But I can see people are bleeding out here, and they need Band-Aids." So this really comes down to a classic my body, my choice issue. We have people with money, people with food, people with blankets who want to voluntarily exchange them with other people. We have to respect the my body, my choice principle. And it's another example of how licensing hurts the most vulnerable people in society. Next, we have from Sheldon Richman a Spiked article. What's this about?
The year we finally rose up against the pajama classes. I'm a fan of Spiked. I don't agree with them on everything. They're for both freedom and they want more freedom, or let's say freedom and more democracy. But they, as good as they are, they never seem to acknowledge those two things easily can clash and do clash. Anyway, Brendan O'Neill, who's a political columnist for them, has this cool article about how 2022 was the year of the revolt of the masses. He starts off by saying the laptop elites, the pajama classes, it's hard to know what to call the new establishment, those upper middle class graduates who make up the knowledge economy, who think tweeting is a job, who have faithfully imbibed every woke mantra from trans women or women to wear your mask, who are weighted on hand and foot by the precariat of Deliveroo and Amazon, who loathe the old economy, the one that actually makes things. He's pointing out that an awful lot of people stood up to that elite in 2022, and he hopes it'll continue into 2023. He talks about, for this was the year of almost a constant rumbling and revolting against the laptop elites by farmers, delivery men, truckers. Remember Canada. You know, people who make food and maintain the infrastructure and make it possible for the pajama people to get online and share their pronouns. The reality of the work of working class anger rudely intruded into the fantasy lives of the elites this year. It was brilliant. This sounds like populism because he's not a right winger, Spiked and O'Neill. Actually, they come from the left. They come from sort of a Marxist left, but they're totally disillusioned with the woke progressives these days. It's not the ugly sort of populism we often hear from the right, the Trump fans, but it is a resentment against the elite. And as those of us who have lived through the pandemic, I guess that's everybody here, we know what the elite did. They shut down the economy, never giving any thought to the cost of that. They did all sorts of terrible things. They've done all other things unrelated to the pandemic that neglected the demands and the rights and the freedoms of just everybody else. And they didn't even care what the cost might be to the rest of us. So this is a good article worth consulting. And I keep an eye on Spiked-online.com. It's a good publication in the UK.
Kyle Anzalone, what is the China issue from December 30th?
So, you know, this is another issue like what's happening with Korea, where, you know, we've seen escalation after escalation in 2022. I guess the difference with Korea is, you know, this was going on basically since 2014 and Obama's pivot to Asia, but significantly under the Trump administration, Obama or Biden has only increased the U.S. military operations and maneuvers in the South China Sea. Just in the past week, or I guess 2 weeks now, there was a confrontation in the South China Sea. The U.S. says it was in international waters. My guess that it was in the skies above the South China Sea that are claimed by China. And the U.S. says that, you know, a Chinese fighter plane flew very close to one of our spy planes. The U.S. says it came within 20 feet. I watched the video. It didn't look like 20 feet to me. Obviously, it was very close for two planes flying at a high rate of speed, and obviously something could have gone wrong and caused an accident, but I'm not quite sure it was only that they were 20 feet apart, as the U.S. claimed. But in the time after that, we had China carrying out some naval operations in the waters off of the Japanese claimed island of Okinawa. You know, the people there feel occupied because the half of the thing, or I think about a quarter of the island's a U.S. military base. And then, you know, the rest of the people see themselves, or at least some of them see themselves, as different from the rest of Japan. But then also sailing near the U.S. territory of Guam. And, you know, to Tokyo and to Washington, these are seen as provocations by Beijing. We also, in the past couple of weeks, had China and Russia carry out joint naval and aerial drills in the region, with Russian bombers flying in the same region as Chinese warships. And so, again, I think this is something that we're going to see more and more of in 2023, as the U.S. mentality, the mentality of the U.S. foreign policy establishment is, you know, never bat down. You know, never in any way show weakness, always show more strength. And so if Russia and China are carrying out more naval operations in the region, well, that, you know, we had to carry out more naval operations with our allies. So, you know, we're going to see more Taiwan Strait transits with the Canadians, with the British. You'll see more German warships in the South China Sea, and more, you know, alliances and pacts like the one that was recently made between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, or AUKUS, the U.S., U.K., and Australia, or the quadrilateral dialogue, which is the U.S., India, Australia, and Japan. So, you know, we're putting all these groups of countries together. And, you know, while North Korea is certainly something that this group of countries could be turned against and their militaries could be used against, the main focus is on China.
My final one is from this great book titled There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths. It's a collection of quotes from David L. Bonson. One of the important ones from Matthew Summers I liked was, "Profit is an inescapable category of human action. All action aims at profit. Any act I perform, from reading a book to digging a hole to blinking my eyes, implies an expectation to substitute a more satisfactory state of affairs for a less satisfactory state. Why else would I act? To criticize broadly the desire to profit is to misconceive the impetus to do anything at all whatsoever. But profit is no way limited to material gain, nor to narrow self-interest. People are free to assume the interests of others as their own, and to act on behalf of spiritual ideas. And yet neither case diminishes the expectation to gain from what one is doing. So even in a moneyless society, there are still basically people, everyone, everywhere seeking to profit," which is important because one of the criticisms that we give is, well, this group is a moneyed interest. They're in it to profit. Well, if you take someone like Marco Rubio, who maybe he has no stocks in Raytheon, Boeing, or Northrop Grumman, do you not see how he profits from being a psycho warmonger or the Council on Foreign Relations? I mean, he gets Rubio and the like, and Lindsey Graham, you can fit a bunch of people in there. They get elected they get tons of crowds jumping and cheering their name and waving Rubio 2024 flags and everything else. This is the psychic profit that comes along with everything, even in worker cooperatives where you might have less money or you might have more money because you have a share of the company. The psychic profit of getting a Democratic vote is vitally important to some people and why all libertarians recognize the legitimacy of voluntarily funded worker cooperatives. So once we realize that the free market consists of profit, and that's a uniquely bad thing, you realize one of the primary arguments against us applies many times over to the government because they achieve profit outside of the voluntary sector. It's not like all these teachers and all these professors and all these soldiers and all these cops are just a bunch of unpaid volunteers who just do it out of the kindness of their heart. They get checks just like anyone else. That counts as profiting. Therefore, profit seeking and profit earning is not a justified criticism of the free market because it doesn't apply uniquely to it. Kyle Anzalone, by the way, thank you to everyone who helped us reach this goal of raising money in the end of last year. Kyle, what would you tell people to go check out at libertarianinstitute.org? There's so much to look at. Where should they start? What can they find there?
I tell people to check out the news section every day. I am the news editor. The news team is myself, Will Porter and Connor Freeman. And at this point, you know, we're still doing just about one or two news stories a day, but we're looking to crank that up pretty soon and do a little bit more. But throughout this past year, there's been quite a few stories that if we, you know, weren't the one of the first outlets on the story, we were certainly, you know, the first outlet without the mainstream spin wrapped up in it. We covered a lot of important things like the Washington Post reporting that some NATO members weren't interested in making a deal with Russia to end the war. And, you know, we were writing about that in April, talking about how Zelensky has cracked down the Russian Orthodox Church, cracked down on media, political opposition. That those are all things that we've covered. And then also, you know, U.S. militarism everywhere, including Korea, the South China Sea, Iran, Syria, just, you know, making sure we're trying to stay on top of what the empire is doing. So check out the news section.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. And to the listeners, thanks for watching the Libertarian Institute YouTube and Odyssey channel. Take care, fellas.
Thanks, Keith.